Welcome to Multifamily Real Estate Investing, presented by Mara Poling. My name is Pat Poling. I'm the founder and CEO of Mara Poling, and I'm happy to be with you today for another in our series on key metrics. A little while back, we did an overview of all the key metrics, or most of the key metrics that we use at Mara Poling. And we've taken a deep dive into some, and today we're diving into another, and that is loan to value. As is always the case, feel free to shoot me an email, pat@marapoling.com, and swing by the website for lots of good educational material, marapoling.com. And today we're going to be talking about loan to value, as I said, and loan-to-value is a term that we use to address and kind of an umbrella for a number of different metrics that fall under loan-to-value. So we're going to talk about loan-to-value, loan-to-cost, and loan-to-purchase price. And in the Mara Poling model, each of those serves a different purpose and has some different benchmarks associated with them. I get a question fairly regularly from folks like yourselves that will reach out to me. Again, shoot me an email, or you can go to the website and set up time for us to have a chat on my calendar. But I'll get a common question, which is, so what kind of loan to values do you guys use? And that's really a portion of the question. The intent behind the question, as I always interpret it, is what kind of risk do you take on? How much leverage are you using? Are you over-levered? And when you use the term modest risk, what does that mean? Modest is a pretty vague term. You've heard some of our sessions before where we've talked about debt. Zero debt, right? Would be completely risk-averse from a lender standpoint. There's other risks you take on when you are completely unlevered. And being 100% or more would be extraordinarily risky. And somewhere along the way, it goes from being modest and appropriate to more aggressive to high risk and ultimately inappropriate, right? And not sustainable. So what's that look like? Where's those lines? How do we draw them? Loan to value is the metric that does that, right? So let's talk about the three pieces of it that I just described. Loan to value, loan to cost, loan to purchase price. We're going to start with loan to purchase price. Generally, when people ask me what kind of loan to value do you use, what they mean is the loan to purchase price. So we're going to buy a $10 million property. How much debt are you putting on that? If we're putting on $7.5 million in debt on a $10 million property, that's a 75% loan to purchase price relationship. And typically in the industry and lenders and investors, people will describe that as, well, that's the loan to value. And that absolutely makes sense. I'm not arguing that that's not a way to think about it. We want to break it down into a couple more pieces because there's some other factors to look at that we think are appropriate, right? So one of those is to understand, great, that's the purchase price and that's how much debt is being borrowed, but there's other things involved. Two big items in particular. One is it costs money to buy a property, right? There are legal fees and there's lender application fees and origination fees, and there might be points that are paid to buy down a rate or to buy an early exit option or all sorts of other things. There could be commissions if there was a broker that represented the buy side and there was some relationship there. Not very common, but there could be something like that. If you're building your own portfolio, you're going to have those kinds of expenses. When we add an asset to the fund, the Mara Poling Total Return Fund, as an example, we have those kinds of expenses. Fees, acquisition costs, right? Travel to the assets, third-party inspections, all sorts of different things that go into that. Are those being financed? In they can be, right? There are loans out there that will finance a certain amount of those acquisition expenses. Or are they being funded with cash? We, Mara Poling, we fund ours with cash. We don't borrow those. So that's one item. Another is the capital improvement dollars. So I'm not describing the ongoing monthly capital reserve number that gets paid to the lender. What we're talking about is the fairly significant value add component. So on that $10 million property, there could be something in the neighborhood of $1 million or more in capital improvements that are going to be made. And these are the interior upgrades generally that we've talked about, you know, appliances and flooring and paint and countertops and the like, which help drive rent growth and probably some exterior work as well. But generally, it's going to be more focused on interiors. You can borrow that money as well. We do not. So if you take the $10 million property and you add the acquisition expenses and then you add the capital on top of that, what you end up with is a number that's closer to maybe $11.5 million for the total cost of the entire project. And so loan to cost is another way to look at leverage, which takes into account the cash that's being brought in for acquisition expenses and for capital improvements. And generally speaking, we're going to try and end up with a loan to cost number that's somewhere in the 70% range. We might even get down into the 60s. We'd really like to be pretty close to 70, and I'm going to describe why in a moment. But that means that our loan to purchase price is probably going to be around 75%, something in that range. So 75% there, and then somewhere in the 60s upwards towards 70. And a lot of that has to do, obviously, with how much capital work is going to be done and what the acquisition expenses actually were and those sorts of things. So that's loan to cost, that's loan to purchase price. And then we do use a term loan to value, which if you think about that for a moment, loan, so right, the amount of debt that's outstanding relative to the value of the property. Well, the value of the property is what it could be sold for at any given point in time. So upfront, when you buy the property, obviously you're buying it for effectively what the value of it is, right? You willing buyer, willing seller, all that good stuff. But it's kind of confusing then those first couple of years, the value really isn't going to grow dramatically in year two or year three, because you're putting all that capital in, but it takes time for those rents to move, right? You got to cycle through an entire year before you get a chance to move everyone's rent, even some amount. And you're not going to do all the improvements in 12 months, at least we wouldn't. It maybe takes 2 years or more to get through all those. So it'll take some time for that rent movement to fully move through the process. And rent movement is what's going to drive NOI movement. And NOI is what drives value, right? So increasing NOIs relative to a cap rate gives you an increase in value. As that value increases, your loan balance is doing one of two things generally. And that is, it's either going down because every month you're paying a fully amortized payment, right? So we're paying $50,000 in debt service, and there's $2,000 of that that's principal reduction or whatever the number might happen to be. The next month, there's going to be a little more principal reduction in that $50,000 debt payment because we paid some of the principal down the month before. So our principal is slowly decreasing. Well, as the principal goes down, that's the loan side of the loan to value. And at the same time, NOI is increasing, and it's increasing in a very positive way those first 2 years. It just takes 2 years to get fully through that improvement cycle. So by the time you get to year three, there's been a substantial increase in NOI, which drives a significant increase in value. So loan to value is going to be dropping as we go forward, and drops fairly significantly when you get to year three and as you move beyond that. So that's one of the reasons that we want to start in that high 60, almost 70 range, because we're going to drop into the 60s pretty quickly. And then we're going to get into the 50s, even into the 40s. And when we get to those numbers, when we get into the low 50s and we're headed towards the 40s, we have a meaningful amount of lazy equity inside the asset. Nothing wrong with having that lazy equity. It's not hurting anyone, but we're paying something for it. We're paying a price because it's not doing anything. It's just sitting there, and it's not really making the property more secure. Our debt payment is still the same size that it was, right? It's not as though as the amount of outstanding debt we have relative to the value of the property, it's not as though the debt payment goes down because of that. Now, obviously, the amount of income we have is going up. The amount of net operating income is going up. And so we're getting a bigger cushion. You'll see that break-even occupancy number is dropping as well during that time frame. So there's absolutely value being recognized as we go forward, but it's getting lazier and lazier. And when we get out around year five is generally when we're going to break into that low 50s, high 40s range. And that's one of the triggers to say, let's think about doing something with this asset. It might involve refinancing or supplemental debt or potentially a 1031 to get that equity working again and doing something from that standpoint. So that's one way that it moves. Another is you might have a debt structure in which there's some interest only period, right? So we might have a loan that's maybe it's a 10-year loan and we've got 3 years of interest only. So for the first 3 years, the only increase that we're seeing in the loan to value, the only gain, meaning a decrease in the actual loan to value, the only gain that we're seeing there is from the growth in NOI, because the amount of debt that's outstanding stays the same because we're not making a principal payment on a monthly basis. We're paying $48,000 in interest, and that's all we're paying. And the next month we pay $48,000 again, and so on and so on. And again, I'm kind of making those numbers up. I didn't do any math this morning on what the debt would be on $7.5 million on a $10 million loan, and so on. As we go forward, those numbers are both going to drop, those loan to value numbers, and we are looking at them over time. So in that way, we want the loan to cost, which also means the loan to purchase price, but the loan to cost is really the number to keep an eye on. We want that loan to cost number to be reasonably high. Now, we don't want it at 90%. And by the way, nobody's going to loan us 90%. But, you know, we'd like to be close to 70 if we could, because we want to start out with enough room. We don't want to be in a position that after 3 years, we've got a bunch of lazy equity and now we need to do something. We'd like to run a longer period of time, one, so that we can enjoy the cash flow from all this positive growth that we've created. And two, there's a lot of tax value in assets over effectively the first 5 years. There's value over the entire hold period, but in particular over that first 5 years. We like to tie those together, right? So that the tax advantages and the increases in lazy equity kind of reach a crossing point around year five, and then that's the magic trigger to go and do something from that standpoint. So like I said, close to 70, and then when we get to 50 or drop below 50, it's time to go do something. So how do you move it, right? How do you, if when we're putting this together and we're doing the underwrite, if the loan to value and loan to cost and loan to purchase price, if they're not meeting these standards, right? If we're above, right? If we've got too much leverage, if we're above that 70% number, approaching 75, what do you do about it? Well, one of the things obviously you can do is you can just borrow less, right? That's certainly one of the things that we can do. But another is take a look at the capital program, right? Because when we're talking about loan to cost, we need to look at the entirety, at everything that we're doing there. And we can take a look at the capital program. So we might look at restructuring the debt relative to how much capital work are we actually going to do? And when will we be funding that? Are we funding a great amount of it up front? Is it being funded over time? And so on. The biggest lever we have is the purchase price of the asset. The more we pay for the property, if you on a loan to cost basis, the biggest cost item is the asset, right? A $10 million property with $1.5 million in these other items gets you to 11 and a half million. Well, 10 million out of 11 and a half is, I don't know what that is off the top of my head, 85%, something like that. It's a huge chunk. So if that became 9.8 million, that changes the equation substantially, right? And that's going to change the debt structure as well, because a lender is going to look at that number and they're going to moderate the amount of leverage that you're able to have based on that lower purchase price. So I know that sounds kind of obvious. Gee, you can make the deal better by getting it for a bit lower purchase price. But if we understand and look at the relationship of all of these, we want to be in a position where the amount of rent increase that we're going to get relative to the capital that we're putting in, relative to the purchase price we've paid for that asset, that those items are all lining up. And if they're not, if some of those are out of line, then what we may be finding is that we're going to be bumping up against the upper limits of these numbers of against loan to purchase price and loan to cost. And that we're not going to see necessarily kind of movement in loan to value that we want to see over time. One of the ways that we know we're bumping up against that is not this metric. It's the break-even occupancy and the debt service coverage ratio metrics. Those metrics help us understand if we've got the right kind of the optimal leverage or debt structure in place to start with. So none of these key metrics, this is a good point, none of these metrics operate in a vacuum, right? None of these is simply a number we look at and say, okay, that's a good number or that's a bad number. I like where we are, I don't like where we are. Anything that we're going to do to address the performance of one of these metrics is going to have an impact or be driven by one of the other metrics that's there. NOI being the largest one, as we've talked about, right? Because NOI is ultimately what drives cash performance of the asset. It drives the equity growth. NOI growth here is going to drive the loan to value performance over time. It's also going to drive the amount of leverage you get up front, because NOI less some other items is going to give you that debt cover ratio, and it's going to be the driver behind break even occupancy. So all those things together are going to tie in. You're going to continue to see that NOI is buried inside every one of these key metrics. That's why we call it the key metric. It's really the key metric that makes the most sense from that standpoint. So when you get ready to talk to somebody about debt, right? You give me a phone call, you shoot me an email, you're talking with another sponsor, or you're looking at doing a deal on your own, I would encourage you to do this, or to ask questions to tell me what this looks like. Go beyond the what's the loan to value. Ask the question, what's the loan to cost? Going in on this asset, how much of the total cost is being raised in cash versus how much of that is being brought in through debt? How much of that debt then, what's the percentage of that debt relative to the purchase price? Right, which is typically what people will say when they mean loan to value. And then over time, what's that effective loan to value going to look like? As the property performs and grows in value and the debt is retired month by month by month, what goes on with that? At what point in time do we cross some line that triggers some sort of activity, or does it not happen, right? There may be investments you look out there where, well, we don't ever do anything. We just let it run. Or others that simply use higher debt. And that's another good point. The benchmarks we use are around security and stability. This does not mean that if someone uses 80% purchase price debt to start with, that that's a bad investment. It simply has a different risk profile than the kinds of investments that we would look at Mara Poling. And if you're a sleep well at night investor, I would encourage you to give some thought to this. You most likely want to be on our end of the spectrum as opposed to those more aggressive ends. That doesn't mean that you might not have some money. I certainly invest this way, where I've got some money that I do fun stuff like that. I invest in properties or investments that have a little more risk associated with them. It's a very small portion of my portfolio. It's simply there to scratch that itch, if you will, and to occasionally enjoy some upside. It's also money that if I don't get the return I want out of it or actually lose some of it, I'm comfortable with that because it's a very modest amount of my portfolio. But most of my portfolio looks like this sleep well at night money. And my guess is for many of you, that's the case as well. So the next time you reach out and talk to me and you ask the question about loan to value, don't be surprised when the answer comes back, well, this is what our loan to purchase price looks like, but this is what our loan to cost looks like. And that's, we think, a better measure of understanding how we put a property together as opposed to borrowing acquisition costs and financing capital improvements and the like. I hope you found today's session valuable. As I said, shoot me an email, pat@morapoling.com, if you have questions. And we're going to continue this series over the next several weeks. We have a number of items still to come. NOI growth, NOI, as I said, kind of buried in the middle of all of these. Principal reduction, debt cover ratio, average rent growth, occupancy, lots of good topics. And we've already covered some that you can jump back and take a listen to. So I hope you're able to join us next week for another episode of Multifamily Real Estate Investing presented by Mara Poling.